welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. I'm Karen Tate, and the music that started the show tonight was Let the Way Be Open by Abigail Spinner McBride, and she hails from Las Vegas, Nevada. Well, tonight our special guest comes to us by way of a referral by a friend of the show, Lydia Rule, and she is Virginia Bean Rutter, author of Woman Changing Woman, Restoring the Mother-Daughter Relationship, also Celebrating Girls, Nurturing and Empowering Our Daughters, and Embracing Persephone, How to Be the Mother You Want for the Daughter You Cherish. And we're going to be discussing the Navajo Canalda Ceremony as a template for raising daughters from birth to puberty. Demeter Persephone as role models for teens and 20s in mother-daughter relationships. And the archetype of the sacred feminine in dreams and frescoes from ancient Thera. And you might know that as the island of Santorini in the Mediterranean. And much more if time allows. Now, remember, if you can't listen at 6 p.m. Pacific or 9 if you're on the East Coast, you can always catch the show or any other show later from the archives at your convenience. If you can't tune in live and have questions, you can always email yours in advance several days before the show. And we're also on iTunes. So thank you very much for your input and your feedback and also your contributions that help keep the show on the air. And your comments are always welcome. Please post those on the show page. So stay tuned. Call in if you like. And if you're listening live, the number to call in is 718-766-4662. And before we get to this interesting subject or assortment of subjects with Virginia, I have just a couple things for you. First, next Wednesday, we have returning to the show the New York Times best-selling author, Frank Schaefer. Now, some of you probably remember Frank. He's been in the news of late because of all the right-wing Christian fundamentalism that's been going on and all the craziness against Columbia and Libertas and Amaterasu and, you know, all of that stuff that's been coming out of the right-wing folks these days. Well, Frank used to be one of those folks when the right-wing was just sort of gearing up for everything we see in the news today. And he's got a new book out called Sex, Mom, and God, How the Bible's Strange Take on Sex Led to Crazy Politics and How I Learned to Love Women and Jesus Anyway. Well, Frank's always a lot of fun. If you recall, if you're a regular listener, last time he compared right-wing fundamentalists to those folks who lived in the Bronze Age. So tune in next Wednesday. I'm sure you'll hear a lot more in his opinions on Rick Perry and Michelle Bachmann and all the rest. Please save the date. Sacred Sundays have started at the Green Man in Hollywood after our being on hiatus for a while. And the feedback from those who have been coming, they say it rocked. They're so glad we're doing this. They can't wait to come every week. So you might want to save the date. We'll be doing this every fourth Sunday of the month. The next service is September 25th. It's a very eclectic service, honoring the divine feminine and sacred masculine. It's for men and women. They're singing, sharing, wisdom telling, really a great way to connect with the community. And, you know, maybe sort of encourage yourself to carve out some sacred space for yourself at least once a month. So check my webpage, KarenTate.com. Go to the Sacred Sundays button and see what it's all about. And I'm one of the Sacred Feminine facilitators of the services. So make sure you say hello if you can make it later on this month. I also want to tell you about the Occupation of Washington coming October 6th. It's called Stop the Machine, Create a New World, and it's going to be at Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C., as I said, starting October 6th. The call goes like this. It says, join the October 2011 coalition, groups who advocate for peace and social, economic, and environmental justice, and a sustained occupation and nonviolent resistance to stop the machine and create a new world. What is the machine, you might ask? Well, it's corporatism. It's militarism. And what new world is possible? Well, we say one in which people's needs are more important than corporate profits, in which we unite our struggles for jobs, education, housing, health care, and human rights, in which we are free to implement solutions for a peaceful, just, and sustainable world. So if you're in Washington, D.C. area, please come October 6th. Plan to stay for a while. And if you can't come to Washington, at least know about it. Share the information. Maybe set up something in your hometown to attune with the people who are going to be fighting the fight in Washington. You can go to their website, October2011.org. Learn more about it. Take the pledge. Spread the word. History is knocking, and it's up to you if you answer the call. Let's see what else I wanted to share with you. I wanted to make sure you're aware of the Super Congress that's about ready to start. Here's hoping someone in authority actually files suit or takes some action to stop the Super Congress or neuter the Super Congress that was proposed by Obama and the Republicans that came about from that debt ceiling debacle. The Super Committee, or Super Congress as it's called, is giving a dozen congressmen all the power and control. And that subverts our democracy and constitution. If you don't know about this, please take some time to read up on it. It's important. Some say it's a violation of our constitution and the system of checks and balances designed to keep legislation from not being passed without sufficient consensus. It could be a dangerous and slippery slope. No dozen people should have all of our lives in their hands. And as many have said, and I agree, it's far too small a body that can too easily be corrupted. And as we've seen happen time and time again, how many of us believe the Democrats will stand up and hold their ground and protect Social Security and Medicare when faced eyeball to eyeball with these crazy Tea Party thugs who will never compromise on anything? So people, get angry, get activated, get organized. Stop the Super Congress, the Tea Party, and the Republican machine. You know, listeners, these people are the antithesis of Goddess ideals, which are about negotiation and partnership, balance, and justice. These are corporate pawns who want to privatize the country and destroy our social safety net. They've already shown they care nothing for working class people. So I don't know how I can be any clearer. It's up to every one of us to stop them. So hopefully I'll see you in Washington the weekend of October 6th. We'll see how long the, you know, if the Freedom Plaza is occupied. And we're going to do our best to fight to take back the country and stop the machine and create a new world. And remember, Google Super Congress and go to www.october2011.org. So, thank you for your patience, and that brings me to tonight's announcements and comments to a close, and I can actually talk to our wonderful guest, Virginia Bean Rutter. I've been looking forward to this for some time. Let me start by telling you a little bit more about her. I've already told you about her books, but she's a Jungian analyst who trained at the Jung Institute of Zurich in San Francisco. Her first master's degree in art history from the University of California, Berkeley, and an early sustaining love of Greece developed into a passion for studying ancient myths and rites of passage through art, archaeology, and psychology. These studies grew out of her clinical practice and coalesced around archetypal themes of initiation as they manifest in the unconscious material of women and men today. She's the author of those books I mentioned earlier, and she also has an article out called her most recent article, Saffron Offering and Blood Sacrifice, Transformation Mysteries in Jungian Analysis. It's a chapter in the book Ancient Greece, Modern Psyche, Archetypes in the Making, which she co-edited with Thomas Singer. So hopefully we'll get a chance to ask her about that too. So Virginia, finally, I'm getting to you. Thank you for being on the show.
You're welcome. I'm pleased to be here.
Well, good. Well, you know, let me start by telling you that one of the reasons I found out about your work when I was talking to Lydia Rule was I was discussing with her. I was in the Phoenix Museum, and they had for people to watch a short, or I should say several short clips of the Navajo Canalda. Am I saying that right? Canalda ritual?
It's actually Kinalda.
Kinalda. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so for listeners who might not be familiar with that, that's the ritual for young girls when they reach puberty, right?
Yes, in the Navajo.
In the Navajo. Now, yeah. They only showed brief little clips,
mm-hmm.
and I just got the feeling, we're not seeing the good stuff. And honestly, it's hard for me even to remember now what we did see, but it was all stuff that was very public. She was dressed in a beautiful outfit. I think, there was a lot of food involved. But is there more that happens in that ceremony sort of behind the scenes, the more intimate stuff, maybe involving sacred blood or a trial she may have to go through, to prove she's a woman?
Yes.
I'm just curious.
Yes. Well, Karen, actually, this was the first puberty ceremony that I studied, as I noticed the emergence in women's dreams in my practice of certain motifs. And some of those motifs are hair combing, dressing in beautiful clothing, as you mentioned, adorning with jewelry, and receiving instruction. But the other side of the ceremonies are more challenging, and they are the more active things that the girl is required to do. And in the Navajo, one of those is running a race every day, and she gets to set how far she goes. She ties a little string around a creosote bush in the desert, and then the next day she goes farther. So, and that's for 4 days, twice a day. And she has to run in those beautiful clothes and in that jewelry. And that's part of an endurance ceremony. Another thing she has to do is to grind corn for the sacred cake, which is done... some of it is done with the old mortar and pestle, as it used to all be done. But, for instance, in the particular one that I talked about in Woman Changing Woman, it was 30 pounds of cornmeal. So some of it is also commercially ground. And then she has to help stir it, and other women help her do that. And then the cake is baked in the ground. And... then she offers the cake at the end, as if she is offering her body in a way to others, and she does not eat the cake. So there isn't anything specific about blood, that at least that I know about. The mystery part of the ceremony takes place in an all-night sing in a hogan, which...
So I would imagine if you're not Navajo, you're not invited to that.
Not that part, no. But otherwise, it's a huge ceremony, and people come from all around, hundreds of people come, because the essence of it is that the girl becomes changing woman. She becomes the deity of the Navajo people during the ceremony. And therefore, everything she touches and everything she does is a blessing to the tribe. So... anything she touches, there's also a molding and massage part of the receptive ceremony. And those blankets are donated by other people so that when they take the blankets back, they get to enjoy and receive the blessings that she imbued them with. The jewelry, a lot of it is donated.
I see.
The clothes are made specially for the ceremony.
And she gets to keep that almost like a wedding dress or something?
Yes.
Okay. Well, and I'm imagining, do people who are sick maybe come for her blessing, or new babies?
Yes, a lot of babies. There's a stretching ceremony where she puts her hands on the sides of the children and pushes them up so that they will grow, and they sort of file past her in order to receive that. It's very beautiful. And in the White Mountain Apache, which you may have seen, there is a White Mountain Apache clip in the Phoenix Herd Museum with a girl. In that one, instead of running a race, which is what it's called in the Navajo, She has to dance in a circle all day long, and she has a staff that is specially made for her that she uses at this ceremony, and it's decorated with special feathers, and everything has intense meaning. And then that is the staff that she uses when she's an old woman and is not able to walk on her own. So she isn't that wonderful?
It is that she keeps it all her life, and I think that's just incredible. Well, forgive me. I'm always the one that has to look behind the locked door. I'm really curious what happens in the Hogan. And so let me just put it out there to my listeners. If you know anyone who, you know, has attended one of those ceremonies, please get in touch with me, because, you know, not that we want to reveal anything that maybe shouldn't be revealed, but if it's something that can be talked about, you know, I find this, you know, I want to recapture all of this, you know. I mean, I think that, you know, the more people know about this, I think it's so important that women return ritual to their lives, sacredness mm-hmm. to their lives. And, you know, and these are living examples of people doing that. Mm-hmm. And it just feels like it can be such a teaching tool, you know, not really, you know, I'm not looking at it, you know, from the perspective of a voyeur, you know?
Yes. Well, I think that in terms of one of the things that I know goes on there is that there's chanting all night long and the girl has to stay awake for it. But, you know, on a deeper level of mystery, Karen, the point that I'm making is that these rituals are active in the psyche, and that even though they've been lost to most of our culture, our Western culture, that this initiation process is going on in the psyches of women in deep psychotherapy or analysis all the time. And I have found that these images and these living entities, for instance, say, of changing woman who grows old and then young again with the change of the seasons, or Demeter or Persephone or Kuan Yin or Hecate, Psyche, I mean, whomever. It could come through a grandmother, it could come through an aunt, it could come through an ancestor, it could come through an experience such as those you offer. But it's possible to touch the sacred feminine, and the psyche is continually delivering up that kind of energy. All you have to do is touch it.
So even if you don't know about these things, it's almost like it's in our DNA. I mean, it will come up in the psyche anyway?
It will. It comes up out of the collective unconscious, as Jung called it, share by virtue of being human. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'll reveal a little bit myself here. I feel a little bit left out. I don't recall ever having dreams like that. So what if other listeners out there are the same as me? What does that mean if you haven't really, you know, had the dreams about the brushing the hair, the instruction, you know, the things that you mentioned a few minutes ago?
Well, it doesn't always come in a ritualistic archetypal form. You know, it may come in a negative way. For instance, someone may dream that, you know, their girlfriend's hair, you know, is so much nicer than theirs, and they feel that there's this tremendous, you know, envy, and why can't I be like her? Or, you know, maybe she thinks she's better than I am. You know, this kind of ordinary energy around these feminine motifs, if you start looking at those, you see that there's an archetype behind them.
And
you see that maybe the girlfriend has some feminine quality that is actually trying to realize itself in your own psyche. And
so the hair is the significant part. The hair is sort of an archetypal symbol for women.
Yes, the hair. Jewelry is a huge archetypal symbol for women.
Okay.
And it can come up in any form, and it comes up in ways to serve the individuation of the individual woman, not in the pure form that it came up in the ceremony. But if you look at the ceremonies, then you can look at your own dreams and you can see what's going on. And in Woman Changing Woman, I follow three patients of mine whose material I had permission to use, and all of their dreams and that work is all laid out there.
Okay, and that book is obviously still available, Woman Changing Woman.
Yes, it was republished in 2009.
Now, didn't you say the title changed? It's now Restoring...
The Mother-Daughter Relationship, yes.
Okay, all right. So it's now Restoring the Mother-Daughter Relationship. Okay.
And the reason for that is because the mother-daughter relationship is the fundamental archetype between a woman analyst and a woman patient or psychotherapist and client. And that was, I mean, the book wasn't changed. It's that theme was already there. And of course, the mother-daughter relationship is very important in these initiation ceremonies because the mother is the first model for the sacred feminine, right?
That the daughter
should
sees
be.
You be.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Maybe I started in the middle rather at the beginning. So let's go back to the beginning. What led to you first writing Woman Changing Woman, which we know is now Restoring the Mother-Daughter Relationship?
Right. Well, the main thing that led to it was that I was pregnant and bearing children at the same time that I was beginning my psychotherapy practice, even before or just as I was becoming an analyst. And there was this tremendous constellation around the archetype of birth and death, and the archetype of birth, death, and rebirth, because women that I was seeing, one woman in particular that I write about, for instance, with my second child, she got pregnant just right before I did, and then she had an abortion, and she didn't know I was pregnant. And then a couple of months later, I had a very late miscarriage. So we both experienced death in the middle of that birthing energy. She wanted to keep the baby, but her boyfriend didn't. And then we both got pregnant within a month of each other and had baby girls within a month of each other.
Wow.
And all of that time, as I was looking at my own dreams and looking at her dreams, you know, there was a tremendous unconscious constellation around. We were both carrying baby girls around the mother-daughter archetype. Mm-hmm. And then I had an old friend in the Southwest who knew the Kinal Da very well and introduced me to that. And he also introduced me to a photographer who had taken beautiful images of the ceremonies. And so it all just grew out of that. The three foci in the book are menstruation, birth, and then feminine spirituality.
Okay.
And it's all out of the body. And I totally agree with you that that ritual is so important. I believe that women's menstrual cycles predispose them to ritual, and that this is part of the reason why the psychotherapeutic container is, which is a ritualistic container. It's once a week. It's very regular. It has a form. It has a purpose in which the individual can express themselves. And lots of ritual energy comes up within that container. And I think that's eminently suited to women.
Well, Virginia, maybe this is, off, maybe let's put it this way, sort of a peripheral question. But do you think the fact that women don't have these rituals anymore, do you think it's by coincidence or it's a purposeful patriarchal strategy?
Oh, well, I think it's definitely originated with patriarchal strategy, and I think it's embedded in the psyche of women, and it's one of the topics that I took up in an article about the paradox of feminine initiation and analytic work, because I feel that, and what I see, and now over 30 years of practice, is that even as a woman has a health-seeking motive and an individuating motive and an individuating drive in herself, there's always this other side that has come in since Aristotle, that she's second class, her body is inferior, and she's not worth as much as a man. And, there's been a lot of feminism, and I know it will go forward, but it's still there. So
right.
A woman is always struggling with that tension between the embedded patriarchal denigration, or as Jung says, woman always stands in man's shadow. So it's something that has to be talked about and dealt with all the time. It's part of the process.
Well, do you think women who have an easier time embracing, say, their masculine, maybe don't have that issue as much as women who don't, who might not even, I don't know if that makes sense, but I'm just curious.
Well, what would that look like, if you could give me an example?
Well, I guess I'm thinking, a woman who doesn't neatly fit sort of the subservient helpmate role, maybe a woman who feels like she is more empowered, more outspoken. I don't know exactly beyond that. Maybe if I thought about it a little bit longer, I could come up with something, something more. But, I think about, so there's so many women out there who are just sort of complicit in their own oppression, So they would maybe be not the ones who've embraced their masculine, maybe more the feminists, who know about this stuff, who know you have to embrace the feminine and the masculine within yourself. You're not just put on this earth to have babies and help men, achieve their goals or serve the church. I don't know. Maybe I'm just talking out of my head here, but I'm just curious if that makes a difference.
Well, I think that certainly there are all different kinds of women on the spectrum. But embracing the masculine doesn't necessarily mean that you feel good about yourself as a woman. Sometimes it can mean quite the opposite, that you have pushed away the feminine in favor of what you see, often through the father, where the power lies. You see, so it depends. It really depends. It's a very individual thing.
That makes sense. So let me rephrase the question. I wonder if the woman who has a more balanced psyche and embraces both the feminine and the masculine, if this isn't as much of an issue for her.
Well, if she has truly done that, and that's certainly the goal in therapy, is to find that wholeness, whether you're a man or a woman. It's to have both sides. But as you earlier said, the patriarchal set is already that woman is inferior.
Yeah.
So women always have to deal with that somehow, whether they dealt with it before or, some people do deal with it earlier on. And if they have a good mother-daughter relationship in the early years, then they're more likely to have dealt with it and embraced their woman-identified nature.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, this makes me think about these young women, the Navajo women, the Apache women.
Mm-hmm.
They still have these rituals. But yet, and I know we're talking about maybe different tribes, so I'm making a generalization here.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but you hear all the time about how Native American women are victims of domestic violence in huge numbers. And I guess I'm wondering, and maybe I'm not, you know, I'm connecting dots that maybe shouldn't be connected, but I'm wondering if they are still retaining these rituals of empowerment, then, you know, why the domestic violence?
Well, that's a really good question. I think one of the answers is that the alcoholism, because that is a really, really big problem among Native Americans. They're very susceptible to alcohol, and that's a long-standing problem. I think the fracturing of tribes has also influenced, but I know that there is a very strong emphasis on keeping these ceremonies going into the future, and that the tribal leaders who are invested in the health of the tribe are definitely very much behind it. I should also say that there are a lot of differences between tribes. The Kinalda is a matrilineal culture. The land passes through the mothers, through the women. And when a girl marries, the husband comes and lives in the girl's house.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the other way. And that
mm-hmm.
that makes a tremendous difference.
So that means if there's a divorce, the husband leaves and the woman and the children keep all the assets.
Right. And that matrilineal mother, grandmother, daughter energy is kept intact. So I'm not idealizing this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really talking about it, you know, from an archetypal level but from knowing that this is currently going forward, you know.
Right.
It's not something that's been abandoned in the past.
Well, I can't help but draw comparison between the mothers and grandmothers and tribesmen, I'm assuming men too, who want to keep this alive for the health of their community, and then you compare that to, say, other mothers and daughters in cultures who are, instead of promoting something like this, they're instead keeping female genital mutilation alive.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Right.
You know?
Yes,
so
yes.
Wow, we have, you know, we have mothers on all ends of the spectrum, don't we?
We do. We do.
We know that. We know
yes.
that from our own lives and our friends' lives. Before we get on to the Demeter Persephone myth, was there anything more we should say about the Navajo Kinalda?
No, I think we've really gone into that quite in depth. It's a beautiful ceremony, and people should look it up, you know. And I will spell it because it's such an unusual spelling. It's Kinalda, Kinalda.
And now, is there, besides that little video at the Phoenix Museum, and of course, well, your book talks about it, but is there a way to see this visually? I mean, or do you know if there are documentaries out there? Or
I haven't seen any documentaries. I have some photographs in the book from the ceremony, black and white photographs, but I think if you Google it, you'll find the most up-to-date information.
Okay, good. All right, so let's go ahead and leave the the North American continent, and let's go to the Mediterranean, Demeter and Persephone. Now, you're saying that they can be an archetype for relationships between mothers and daughters, but daughters when they get a little bit older, when they're in their teens and 20s.
Right. Well, and the reason for that is because what happens in the Demeter Persephone myth, as I'm sure you and most of your listeners know, is that when Persephone and her mother have a wonderful merged relationship until she gets to be about 12, and then she's picking flowers in a meadow with her girlfriends when Hades comes up from the underworld and snatches her, takes her down, and keeps her there. And she cries and weeps and all of this, but then, and her mother refuses to let plants grow, but eventually when her mother finds out who did it and that her father Zeus was implicated, she says, nothing's going to grow until I get my daughter back, and she sticks to that, and so Zeus relents, but Hades slips Persephone a few pomegranate seeds, and therefore she has to spend part of the year with her now husband, and then she gets to spend part of the year with her mother. But it's very beautiful in the Homeric poem. When she comes back, her mother embraces her, and the two of them are so happy to be back together. And I use this as the central image for a girl separating at puberty and into high school and going off and doing all sorts of outrageous things that her mother is afraid are going to get her in trouble and often do get her in trouble. But for the mother's steadfastness in waiting for the daughter to come back to her and having a certain openness, because Hades really, I mean, you can see it simply as a, you know, she was kidnapped and raped, but it's much more complicated than that. It's the age at which the girl is drawn away from the mother. And Hades represents the unknown, the exciting, the boy, the sex, the, you know, marijuana, whatever. Whatever it is, she's going to be drawn into the unknown in some way. So I really think it takes all a mother's resources to both remember that she was young at one point and doing some of the same things, and also staying in communication with her daughter and receiving her back when she comes back, whether that's back for the night or back from whatever.
Well, you know, I'm glad you explained the myth that way, because I was, had planned to ask you, the circles that I keep, you know, we talk about stuff like this, obviously.
Sure.
Some of the women that that I know could not accept the fact that this rape of Persephone was really a rape. And the way you describe it, well, they weren't thinking of it that way necessarily. At least they didn't verbalize it beautifully the way you did. You know, this, you know, the mother has to let her go to sow her wild oats, you know, to grow a little bit, to test her independence almost.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But what they were saying was it couldn't have been a literal rape. I'm not sure if literal is the right word, but it couldn't have really been a rape, you know, something brutal, an assault. They were saying it wasn't necessarily this, you know, man against woman assault, because, mm-hmm. Just the idea that these original Greek myths, before they were, you know, before the patriarchal times, that would have been unthinkable in the culture, you know, when
mm-hmm.
women were empowered. So the rape idea just never really sat right, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't feel right that it could have, that it had to have been a patriarchal insertion of dominance or something, but that wasn't really the original intent.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's very interesting on several levels. I mean, first of all, the myth never says rape in the ancient Greek, and I have looked at that. I mean, it doesn't say rape. It says he did something with his hands, which infers something magical, and slipped her the pomegranate seeds. Now, at this point, she's been released, and she's about to leave the underworld and follow the god Hermes up. So she's very excited, and she probably doesn't quite notice what's going on, and she's so happy. You know, you can imagine all sorts of things. Now, that could be a sexual metaphor that he slipped her the pomegranate seeds, right?
Right.
Of course it could. But you know, she is in an age where her sexuality is beginning to awaken and her lust. So how much desire is involved? Also, your friends or yourself are absolutely right. He wanted her for his queen. He didn't he wanted her to be in the underworld with him because he was isolated and alone there. And she gains in power from that abduction.
Right.
You know, she becomes a queen. She gains a real name.
Well, yeah, because, you know, they would like to see it more as a love story, you know, that maybe it wasn't this, you know, this assault and this kidnapping, you know, and they just couldn't imagine that, you know, that would have been originally written into the myth. You know.
Well, I think it was originally part of the written myth, but it is based on an older vegetation cycle of, you know, the plants going into the ground this time of the year and coming up in the spring. You know, on what happens to plants organically. They die off, they go under, and they come back. And this evolved into this archetypal mother-daughter tale with so much power. I mean, in the only Western mother-daughter tale we have. But, you know, this leads me actually to the article you mentioned about Santorini, ancient Thera, because what I found there in these prehistoric frescoes, so these are from 1700 BC, and when I first saw them there, about 10 years ago, and they only were they've only started to be excavated since the early 70s, were initiation ceremonies, the initiation ceremonies in which the girls are completely intact and whole in themselves and not being threatened with abduction. And they're very, very beautiful.
Well, and that sort of, you know, plays into what I was saying earlier, because Greek Hellenistic time, isn't that when things got more patriarchal?
Yes, 4th century B.C., Aristotle, yes, and the age
prior
of,
to that, is what do you call that time period? That's more the...
Well, this is Aegean, Minoan... you know, Crete, the Minoan, Aegean period.
Right.
Yes, is the pre.
Yeah, and it just, it maybe plays into the idea that, you know, the woman, it wouldn't have been an abduction again.
Yeah.
But, it would be more of you could see her, like you said before, this was just her way of growing up. I mean, it's a tale of Persephone growing up and, you know, not, you know, just being at her mother's side. She becomes, you know, she becomes a woman and she's exploring her sexuality and, you know, as opposed to, you know, a brutal abduction and rape, which is, you know, so much more patriarchal.
Yes. Well, when it gets to the patriarchal period, the classical Greek, it's very patriarchal. That's where we get Aristotle and where we get. And then you get marriage as abduction. That's the other thing. You see, because unlike the Kinalda and the Navajo people, the girl was taken away from home at her marriage, which happened immediately after her menarche, her first period. I mean, just practically within, you know, months. And she was very young. And it was threatening. She threatened to die in childbirth, and she was taken away, and she often never saw her mother again. So there was a kind of brutality about that separation during the classical Greek period. You're absolutely right.
Oh, okay. So, so you're saying that's what would happen in Greece as opposed to the Native American Navajo.
In Greece during the classical period, in the prehistoric Aegean Minoan period, we do
so
not.
So here
think.
You could potentially have a 12 or a 13-year-old girl taken away, abducted, and forced into a marriage.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, not necessarily stolen, but that was the custom,
the
right?
culture. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Well, now, this is a little bit of a deviation, but let me ask you if my intuition has been right here.
Okay.
I teach Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, the UU curriculum. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
No.
But they talk, the lesson plans is using Demeter and Persephone to improve relationships between mothers and daughters.
Mm-hmm.
And they sort of imply what you said, you know, about how this is a story of, you know, a mother having to let the daughter, you know, learn her independence and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I sort of extrapolated on that, you know, considering how much grief there can be in women's relationships in general. You know, the backbiting, the gossip, you know, all the stuff that Phyllis Chesler talks about in Women's Inhumanity to Women. You know, when I taught Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, I extrapolated on the idea of Demeter and Persephone being a template for good relations between daughters and mothers and took it to the next step and said, you know what, we are all to a certain extent mothers and daughters. Can't we use this myth to say we should have good relationships between women? Now, was that just pie in the sky? Or was there some good intuition at play there?
Oh, I think that's excellent intuition. I think that's great. I think that's part of what has to be healed in patriarchal culture is the competition between women, you know, for goods and men and everything else. So I think that's really nice and very down to earth, and I applaud you.
Well, thank you. Well, I'll continue to do it now.
Good.
You know, because it felt right to me. You know, it felt right. It made sense. But, you know, I've never asked, you know, anyone from a, you know, perspective, you know, an analyst or anything like that.
Could I say one more thing about that?
Sure.
Karen, which is I thought you were going to say, and what I think is another deeper element to emphasize in your classes or elsewhere, is that we are each a mother and a daughter in ourselves, and that to access that sense of relationship between the two within the soul of a woman is very important, because sometimes the young, vital, adventuresome, seeking, or innocent, whatever you associate with the daughter aspect of yourself, you know, disappears, and people go into women go into depression and mourning for not having that vitality.
That's
and that can
point.
Happen at any age.
Absolutely, because I think we have to retain that part of ourselves, you know, throughout life, really. You know, we can't just, you know, we can't let that part of us go.
No, and the depression, the other thing to remember is that Demeter's mourning and depression and grief and screaming produces results. If she hadn't done that, she wouldn't have gotten her daughter back at all. And so it really serves a purpose, and she has more power after it, as well as Persephone. She has.
Aside from, you could say that sort of teaches us the squeaky wheel gets the grease. how would you explain that in more archetypal language, I guess?
You mean in psychological terms?
That's what I wanted to say. In psychological terms, what does that say to us?
Well, a lot of times when the meaning and the vitality and the daughter energy has gone out in a woman, has gone away, has been abducted, let's say, by whatever, perhaps by some life circumstance that just makes her feel hopeless, often that hopelessness makes a woman feel as if there's no use to try, give up, emotionally, not strategize, not realize that there's meaning in the mourning. There's meaning in the grief. That it's right to feel badly because that's a way, and to continue looking as Demeter continues to look for her daughter. And occupies herself with things, goes and is a nursemaid to another family in the meantime while she's grieving. So, you know, it's this not giving up and realizing that there's meaning, that the soul has a purpose there, that the self has a purpose.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for adding that. You know, I think that is awfully important, and I certainly hadn't considered that aspect of it. Very, very nice. And I'm also thinking about the difference between, you know, the Navajo Kinalda, trying to remember how to say that right. You know, because you were saying, you know, with them, when there's a divorce, you know, it's not like in Greece where, you know, the woman becomes the property. There's already a built-in empowerment with the Native American women because it's matriarchal. Mm-hmm. So they don't have to worry so much about the same things that, you know, the women in the patriarchal culture have to worry about.
Right. That's the Navajo.
All the Native American tribes were not matriarchal. So
And I'm not saying matriarchal, I'm saying matrilineal.
Matrilineal,
which is different.
Yeah, you know what, could you clarify that just so that we're accurate here for our listeners?
So matriarchal implies that the women have all the power, the governing power, et cetera. But matrilineal means that the line of property and ritual passes through the female, passes through the grandmother, mother, daughter line.
Right.
So, right.
And even though that's not quite as powerful as the former, it's certainly better than patriarchy.
Definitely, and it should be equal. It shouldn't be, you know, it shouldn't be matriarchal or patriarchal. It should be both.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, now, you also talk about initiation as an archetype in psychotherapy and analysis. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think we have touched on that several times, Karen. It has to do with these initiation motifs coming up in dreams, and then it has to do with the passing from one psychological state to another, so that this growing into being a woman psychologically is a process of initiation in psychotherapy. It's like being initiated into being a woman, identified woman, and owning all your gifts and your skills, which are always already there, and some need to be learned. But it's really becoming at one with being a woman.
I see. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. And
I guess I didn't think of that as an initiation, I wasn't making the connection.
Mm-hmm. Well, so many girls have not been initiated. They've gone through the motions, but no one, you know, took care with them when they had their first period. Many of them woke up in a sea of blood and thought they were dying, you know,
right.
Things like that, or... you know, it wasn't talked about, or it was a shameful thing. And so, you know, and all women are educated in the same system, scholastic system as men, so they learn very well how to be on the left side of the brain, if they're paying attention at all. But to know about feminine mysteries is something... That most women aren't comfortable with. They aren't comfortable with their own bodies. They aren't comfortable with their own psyches. And so it's quite an initiation.
Well, and let's face it, we have big pharma saying, here, take this pill and let's totally get rid of it. You don't need it.
Right, exactly. Yeah, right.
Well, before I let you go, Virginia, I wanted to ask you about that article that was in the book Ancient Greece, Modern Psyche, Saffron Offering and Blood Sacrifice. What was that about?
Well, that is the one that talks about the pre-classical Greek woman who is actually one of this particular island of Santorini, ancient Thera, the saffron crocus plants grew wild, and saffron seems to have been the main artistic motif and the main harvest motif, and there seems to have been a beautiful goddess of nature and animals who presided over these saffron offerings from the girls, and there were also bull sacrifices. And so one of the connections that I make between the masculine and feminine initiations, because it's the men who sacrifice the bull, it's the women who are picking the crocus flowers and doing the saffron processing, is that the women's blood mysteries are the connection there. So the blood of the bull and the blood of the women and their initiation into womanhood is all part of that mystery, and is connected to the archetypes of offering and sacrifice in analytic work.
Well, that's certainly interesting. To read that, well, you'd have to get this book. It's not like you don't have the article online or anything.
No,
like that.
It just came out, the book, a month or so ago.
Oh,
yeah.
That's right. I see here 2011. So right. is that one of those real expensive academic books? No.
No, it's not at all. And it was published by Spring Journal Books, which republished Woman Changing Woman. I believe it's $20.
Okay.
Regular, you know, paperback price. So,
okay.
Anyone who's interested is welcome to look.
So it's very affordable, I would imagine, on Amazon or any of the usual
places.
Yes,
exactly. Yeah.
Okay, wonderful. Well, Virginia, I know we've covered a good bit, but you know, maybe there were things I didn't even think to ask you that were related to any of this. Was there anything else you wanted to touch on? You know, just to sort of round out the topic.
You know, I think we did it, Karen. I so enjoyed your questions.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed having someone like you to ask the questions of.
Anytime.
Well, thank you so much. Now, Virginia, do you have a website or anything like that?
No.
Or anything? Okay.
I think if anybody Googles me, then they find all my books and all my articles and all of that. But I do not have a website.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what I told Jane Caputi last week or week before, I can't remember which. I really wish you ladies would put your classes online, because there's so many people who just don't have access, to this information. You know, they don't have women's studies or, all of these wonderful things that would help empower women. They just don't have access to them. And that's one of the reasons I do the show, because I'll have somebody from a red state call me and say, your show is a lifeline. I can't find this information anywhere else, Or they maybe don't know what books to read or don't have access to it, or,
right.
I don't know, maybe the book can't even come in the mail or something. You know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
So, anyway, I'll just throw that out there.
Okay. Well, I mean, one thing that listeners can do is look to see if there are any young institutes in your area and see what they have to offer in terms of online classes. There, North Carolina... there's a wonderful group of seminars being done online there, analyses of movies like The Black Swan and all different kinds of Jungian concepts from, I guess it's Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and they could certainly go there. And if anybody's in the Bay Area, the Jung Institute in San Francisco has many, many, many resources. So.
And probably online as well,
yes.
I would imagine. And I mentioned earlier the Cakes for the Queen of Heaven curriculum. If you have a Unitarian Universalist church in your neighborhood, they have Cakes for the Queen of Heaven and another curriculum called Rise Up and Call Her Name. And it talks a lot about this, you know, sacred feminine stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, and archetypes, empowerment. You know, it really, I mean, I wish I had known about stuff like this 20 years ago instead of, you know, having to read the 100 books. You know,
mm-hmm.
it sort of consolidates everything.
Cakes for the Queen of Heaven is a great title.
yes, isn't it, though?
Yes.
Well, Virginia, thank you so much.
You're so welcome. My pleasure.
Well, you've been delightful, and I want to thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Karen.
Good night.
Bye.
Well, if you're just tuning in, I hope you'll stay with me because I want to share with you an article that I thought was kind of important. It's called Three Things That Must Happen for Us to Rise Up and Defeat the Corporatocracy. So stay with me if you would. But first, I just want to, mark the threshold of the show as we go into the latter half. And I want to remind you, all of the stuff that we talk about here on the show, all of this that empowers women, that, brings us into wholeness, into happiness, into seeing ourselves as sacred, well, you know, that's all part of the sacred feminine. And adversaries of the sacred feminine, well, you know, they tried to sweep away awareness and knowledge of her for all time. And, you know, and they're still doing it today. And with that sweeping away, you know, when the great she was made to disappear because of the religion of patriarchy, of selfish and disconnected men and their war gods, women and their power, their leadership, their spiritual authority, well, you know, they were thwarted, repressed, became taboo. They were diminished and disrespected. I mean, how many women do you know that are just complicit in their oppression? Because, you know, they are, I hate to use the word victims, but in a way they are victims of the patriarchy. So that's why here on the show I'm dedicated to trying to recover the great she. Whether we talk about the sacred feminine in the guise as a deity or in the guise of an archetype or ideals of the sacred feminine. Yes, here we, every week, I hope I'm doing what I set out to do because, you know what, I want to defy, I want to taste the forbidden fruit, be powerful and uppity women to throw off the shackles, to look under every rock, behind every locked door, peer into the abyss of the past so that we know why things are the way they are. I mean, it's about us standing up and reclaiming our power. And why? Well, because if we want to save ourselves as a species, if we want to save the planet, if we want to save the future, then we have to restore balance, harmony, wholeness, sanity, peace. We just have to. And women with our like-minded brothers, well, I think armed with ideals of the sacred feminine, we can set things back on course to restore some balance, to have that egalitarian society. So let me once again repeat the mottos of the show because you say you like them so much, and I do too. The first one is, and I believe this relates to the topics we talk about, that all truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it's accepted for being self-evident. And the second motto of the show, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. So next time, you know, you feel like, you know, you're on the periphery, you're on the fringes, think about this, because what's old is new again. So, I'd like to get into that article a little bit that I mentioned before. I'm not going to read it all, but it comes from alternet.org. I read a lot of stuff there. They have lots of good articles. And this one was by Bruce E. Levine, and it was posted on August 25th if you wanted to go get a copy for yourself. And it talks about the three things that must happen for us to rise up and defeat the corporatocracy. Bruce E. Levine says, transforming the United States into something closer to a democracy requires, one, knowledge of how we're getting screwed, those are his words, two, pragmatic tactics, strategies, and solutions, and three, the energy to do battle. He says the majority of Americans oppose the corporatocracy. It's just another, I guess it's probably a new word, I don't know, but it's ruled by giant corporations, the extremely wealthy elite like the Koch brothers, I threw that in, and corporate collaborator government officials, which we have so many of. I mean, that's the Republican Party. However, many of us have given up hope that this tyranny can be defeated. Among those of us who continue to be politically engaged, many focus on only one of the three requirements, the knowledge that we're getting screwed. Well, that's not enough. The singular focus can result in helplessness. And you know what? I will totally say I can relate to that. Sometimes it does feel overwhelming, and it does feel like it's hopeless, and it makes you feel helpless. You know, you get to the point where you want to just unplug and stick your head under the covers or bury your head in the sand. So let's understand that we have to. Alongside our knowledge, we have to have these other requirements that can empower us and energize us and activate team democracy, as Bruce Levine calls it. He says a team that's currently at the bottom of the standings in the American political league. So anyway, we know about knowledge, so we don't need to talk about that. He does quote Leonard Cohen. He says, everybody knows that the deal is rotten. Well, maybe not everybody, but damn near everybody. Maybe the folks on Fox don't get it, but the rest of us do. So the other thing, the second part of this three-part equation, the pragmatic tactics, strategies, and solutions, I'll read just a little bit of this for you. He says, in addition to awareness of economic and social injustice created by corporatocracy and the elite, it's also necessary to have knowledge of strategies that oppressed people have historically used to overcome tyranny and gain their fair share of power. He says, even before the Democratic, Republican, bipartisan educational policies such as No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top that cut back on civics being taught in schools, few Americans were exposed in their schooling to street-smart civics, the kind of tactics and strategies that he says oppressed people have historically utilized to gain power. For a comprehensive guide of tactics and strategies that have been effective in transforming regimes more oppressive than the current U.S. one, he says read political theorist and sociologist Gene Sharp's From Dictatorship to Democracy, which includes 200 methods of nonviolent actions. Among Sharp's 49 methods of economic cooperation, he lists over 20 different kinds of strikes. And among his 38 methods of political non-cooperation, he lists 10 tactics of citizens' non-cooperation with government, 9 citizens' alternatives to obedience, and 7 actions by government personnel. Yes, nothing was more powerful in ending the Vietnam War and saving American and Vietnamese lives than the brave actions by critically thinking U.S. soldiers who refused to cooperate with the U.S. military establishment. Then he goes on and he talks about other things that can be done. He lists the book, The Populist Moment. He says, check out the Intelligent Tactics, Guts, and Solidarity in the 1934 Minneapolis trucker strike. And this reminds me, the AFL-CIO leader was just on television this week saying that, they're just not going to automatically stand behind the Democrats anymore if the Democrats aren't going to stand for labor and people's jobs. And, this is the kind of thing that they're talking about here. So, and there's also another book to get called Get Up, Stand Up. Maybe you can get these at your library. So there are things that can be done. We can't just let ourselves wallow in the knowledge and feel helpless. But the most important, he says, the third thing is we have to have the energy to do battle. Like I was talking about at the top of the show, occupation of Washington that's going to happen in October. You know, we just can't sit idly by and be complicit in our oppression. We have to fight. I'm thinking of that V for Vendetta. Remember that movie that came out a while back? Rent it on Netflix. So anyway, yes, we have to have the energy to do battle. The elite's money and the influence it buys is an extremely powerful weapon. So it's understandable that so many people who are defeated and demoralized focus on their lack of money rather than on their lack of morale. However, we must keep in mind that in war, especially in a class war, when one side lacks financial resources, morale becomes even more crucial. So, you know, he talks about comparing the person's abuser. You know, the abuser can be a spouse or the abuser can be the corporatocracy. There are parallels when it comes to how one maintains enough strength to be able to free oneself when the opportunity presents itself. He says for democratic movements to have enough energy to get off the ground, certain psychological and cultural building blocks are required. He says some of these are individual self-respect and collective self-confidence. Without those, you know, people don't believe that they can wrestle power away from their rulers, and that there are democracy battlefields that where wars have to be waged, and those are in our schools, in our workplace, and elsewhere, where respect and confidence can be regained every day. So, in closing. You know, as an example of a, you know, where people have stood up, he said, today in Iceland, citizens have refused to acquiesce to the demands of global financial institutions, simply refusing to be taxed for the mistakes of the financial elite that caused their nation's recent financial meltdown. In March of this year, in a March 2010 referendum in Iceland, 93% voted against repayment of the debt, and Icelandic citizens have been drafting a new constitution that would free their country from the power of international finance. Yes, participatory democracy is still possible. And in closing the article, he said, the lesson from the 2011 Arab Spring in other periods of history is that tyrannical and dehumanizing institutions are often more fragile than they appear, and with time, luck, and morale, our ability to seize the moment, damn near anything is possible. We never really know until it happens whether or not we are living in that time and when historical variables are creating opportunities for change. Thus, we must prepare ourselves by battling each day in all our activities to regain individual self-respect, collective self-confidence, determination, courage, and solidarity. Bruce Levine, the author of this article, he's a clinical psychologist and the author of Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populace, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite. And his website is brucelevine.net. So I think that's really important because I think I think a peaceful revolution is what we probably need in this country. We have to know that, you know, we might not have the money, but we have the numbers. So I hope you'll see me in Washington in October. And if you can't come to Washington, I hope you will do what you can in your own community. And you know what? Even if that means just signing petitions and voting and making sure your friends know the issues and making sure you know the issues, the last thing we need is a bunch of sheeple and people who are being duped with lies and, you know, corporate propaganda. So I guess that's enough of the politics for tonight. I think what I'd like to do is close the show on an up note. So I am going to let you hear something from one of my favorite two groups out in Nevada. And since I did Abigail at the opening of the show, I'm going to do, here we go, here we go, the Sekhmet mix by Zingaya. Sekhmet, the powerful goddess, the archetype that women turn to for personal empowerment. Yes, she's a mother, but she's also a ferocious warrioress. And you know what, ladies, and our like-minded brothers out there, we have to be nurturing, and we also have to be warriors and warrioresses. It's being called for now. You know, it's absolutely being called for. We have to be her sacred roar. We have to demand that the ideals of the sacred feminine actually or would, you know, rule the day in this country. So with that in mind, I'll close the show with something called the Sekhmet Mix by Zingaya. Just listen to her growl. And please be with me next Wednesday when we have Frank Schaefer on the show. We're going to talk about all these crazy extremist Republicans and their obsession with Islamophobia. And you know what? It's not a big leap to see that that can so easily slip into anti-paganism, anti-goddess rhetoric. So I hope you'll be with me because I'm going to specifically ask him about stuff like that. So that's next Wednesday. But here we go. For your enjoyment is the Sekhmet Mix by Zingaya. All hail Sekhmet.
Desert, heart, fire.